a Motorsport Podcast Network production.
Hey everybody, welcome along. Aaron Noonan, great to have you with me. V8 Sleuth Podcast, you know that though if you're a regular listener. If you're not, welcome along. Great to have you with us as we sit down for another of our sit-down chats with a special member of the Australian motorsport family. Now, when it comes to Tassie motorsport, Greg Crick's a name that pops up pretty regularly, and he's been there and done it all. Now, we chatted recently, and it was such a big chat, and we covered so much ground, we've chopped it up into three parts. Part one this week, parts two and three to be released together next week. And as you'll hear over this huge three-parter, he's way too modest about his achievements. A kid who grew up watching Jack Brabham at Longford and idolising the world champ. Greg later became teammates with him at the event that took Tasmania to the world and put Greg on the map, Targa Tasmania. There's piles of stories, plenty of cars to talk about and piles of fun. And there's a bit of emotional stuff too in parts two and three that really goes deep diving into a very difficult time in Cricky's life. If you're a fan of motorsport, I think you're going to love this chat. I know that I thoroughly enjoyed having it with him. So let's barrel in, buckle up, time to start. Part one of Greg Crick on the V8 Sleuth Podcast, and we start with a topic close to both of our hearts. Not motor racing, the AFL. Greg Crick, I thought I'd have to come to Tasmania to do a podcast with you, but you've come to Melbourne. Why? What are you doing here?
I get out occasionally.
They let
not
you
very
out of
often,
the
but
island.
I get out of Tassie every now and then, especially for the first round of the footy, especially when Geelong are playing tonight.
I don't understand. I mean, I know you don't have a team in the AFL yet, and you should. I'm totally on board with
that.
I don't think
we should.
You don't think you should?
No.
Why? Because you'd have to give up supporting the Cats.
Well, Tasmanians are parochial AFL, VFL people, and we've all got our own teams, and we'll have a lot of people converted to Hawthorn when they came to Tasmania, pretended they were Tasmanians.
And they were on board with Hudson years ago.
All they were doing was taking our government's money and turn up there and put on a bit of a show. But we've all got our own teams and we stick to them. Collingwood supporters aren't going to change to a Tasmanian team.
Why don't you have like your second favourite team then?
Oh, we can
if there
that.
Was a Tassie team, would it be your new second, your new favourite second team?
No.
Why'd you pick Geelong?
Geelong? Yeah. When I was about 4 or 5 years old, there was a great big ruckman called Polly Farmer. And he was my hero as a kid when I used to see him take that ball out of the air and handball it further than most people could kick it. And I've been a Geelong supporter ever since.
And you just don't stop reminding me that you are.
No.
Every time
Especially when we win.
Oh, at every trap, I cop it from you. Every time. Thanks for sitting down with me. We've been wanting to do this for a while to catch up with you because there's so many things to chat about. And not long ago, we actually did a chat night, didn't we, down in Tassie at the museum in Launceston with Marcus Ambrose and Owen Kelly and JB. And it's a nice little warm-up for this chat because it started a couple of topics rolling. So am I right in from what you said on that night that you grew up at Longford? Like you were around there all the time back in the day.
Well, I grew up at Perth, which was essentially probably a mile and a half from the Mountford corner on the Longford circuit. So
you could hear the cars.
When we were in school, and we always had our bikes ready to go. You know, they're freshly painted with a couple of spray cans and some clackers on the on
the. I was going to say, you got to have the
spinning clackers. Brand new plastic ones that made as much noise as possible. And as soon as we got out of school, we were up to Longford and I saw the sights and sounds of Longford probably from the time I was 3 or 4 years old because my mum and dad both worked there, as did everyone in the local community. And like if you read Neil Kearney's latest book, you know, Longford, a little town with a big motor, it's all about the town but how they actually managed to run such a big event, motorsport event, in that community with all volunteers. It was amazing.
I noticed how you said that you waited till you got out of school to go to the track. What, you never wagged to go to the track?
Oh, I was primary school. You didn't wag in primary school.
You hadn't discovered your bad boy element yet.
No,
by that
not
stage.
Quite. Not quite. It was sort of bubbling away there, though. I was ready to go.
Yeah. Was it that proximity to Longford that captured you on cars and motorsport and racing?
100%. Yeah. Like, it was just so captivating. Like, you know, we were kids and we were running across the track to get Jack Brabham's autograph and Denny Holm and whoever else was there. And I got my little autograph book still at home with Jackie Stewart, Jack Brabham, Jim Clark, all these autographs that people would die for, you know, and we just used to run across the track between races and get them.
It's just a different world, isn't it? It's like saying to people these days that Lewis Hamilton, Max Verstappen, Sergio Perez, you know,
rattle off all the names of Formula One drivers. They come here during summer to race their season-old car around the roads, around near your house, and you can go and see them. It's the equivalent. It's mind-blowing.
Like, it is.
It's unbelievable.
Yep, and they always used to go to the Longford River and go water skiing. Someone would have a boat there, and they all love water skiing, so they'd be skiing in the Longford River, you know, early in the week before the races started, and they were just – they mixed in the community. Jack Brabham had his car in Launceston doing something at the Repco workshop, and then drove it from Repco workshop in Launceston back out to Longford to the track. You know, it was just a different era.
When did you think, I'm going to go and do this, like I'm going to get behind a wheel?
Then.
Right then?
When I was a kid, like all I ever wanted to do was race cars and ran around the house like an idiot making car noises. it's a lifetime thing. But you see, it was more than just the Formula One drivers. You had all the local people, like, and your local heroes were racing as well. So it was
best of both worlds.
It was the best of both worlds. Like, it was just such a huge event for Tasmania. You're on such a dangerous and unique circuit.
So were you there any of the days when it went really wrong at Longford?
I think it was Friday afternoon when Timmy Mayer got killed there was a hump going towards the old Longford pub, and he lost control when he landed over that hump and speared off and hit a tree, which there were many of them right beside the track. Weren't many safety features in those days, and he was killed then. And I was in close proximity when Rocky Tresice went off just past the control tower and hit a photographer, and he died as well. And there was Dennis Wing on a motorbike, went off under the viaduct and was killed. So, you know, you remember these things, and that was part of the danger and that we accepted of motorsport.
Did that curb or change your approach to it, having seen it? I mean, as, you know, in your teens and as a kid, that's not the sort of stuff that kids in their sporting interests, whether into footy or cricket or basketball or whatever it is, people dying is not standard. It doesn't happen. It's mega, 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 uber, uber rare. But in motorsport, it was par for the course, particularly in that era of the 60s and the like. So that changed the way you looked at the sport moving forward, particularly when you started competing?
No, we didn't think about danger or circuit safety or the things that we look at now. And, everyone's pretty risk averse these days. There wasn't much of that in those days. The best thing they had at Longford was a couple of boats at both bridges with divers, scuba divers on them, in case someone went off the bridge so they might have a chance of diving down and getting them out. But, you know, it was – and I suppose, you know, we weren't too worried about safety. All you wanted to do was be a bit of a daredevil, if you like, and race a car. And we did plenty of practice around that Longford circuit, believe me, when I turned about 17, and there was a lot of laps done around there.
Late night?
Yeah.
What in?
Oh, anything. I had I think the first thing was a XK Falcon, and then it was probably a Cortina or something, but there was plenty of laps done around there. All the local boys used to be up there every night.
It's too far gone now. You're not incriminating yourself or anybody else. Were you mechanically minded at the time, or were you all about driving?
No. I decided very early on, much to the disgust of my father, that I was going to be a mechanic. So that I could race cars, and all I got told was what an idiot I was wanting to be a bloody grease monkey. And he was disgusted because his boss, who was a very well-known man in the Launceston community, had me jobs at the Launceston Bank for Savings as a bank teller and something else that he wanted me to do, and I just rejected all of it to go and be a mechanic. And so I earned the wrath of my father for that.
Did it calm down later on?
Maybe much later on when I started going into business and doing things. But, you know, everything that I did going into business also was a part of being driven by my love of the sport and wanting to continue in the sport. So it was always my goal was to make enough money to be able to go and race something successfully.
Yes, it's not a thing about I'm going to be good at business to make piles of money, but I'm going to make the money to go car racing. Yep. It's pretty much it all. It's a means to an end.
Yeah, it was a means to an end. And people used to say to me when I was young, like, how much money I wasted on motor racing. But to me, it was never, ever a waste, because it was a means to what I wanted to do. And as a result, you know, ended up with quite a successful couple of businesses and and did okay, but the motivation was my love of the sport and wanting to be able to do the sport that I wanted, I love so much.
What was your first race car?
FJ Holden.
How much did it cost you?
$325.
And I love that you remember exactly what it cost you. You're such a car dealer.
I can't remember what happened yesterday, but I remember that because I'll never forget it. It was I bought it off a guy by the name of Doug Young down at Smithton. It used to be Gene Cooks, who was a famous name in Tasmanian motorsport. And, I had my XK Falcon that I'd rebuilt as a road car, and I sold that to buy this FJ. And then Dad was so pissed off with me that he refused to take me to work, even though he drove right past the door and I had to catch the bus to work.
Because so you don't have your road licence at this stage?
It was just before I got my road licence, and I'd done this car up for the last 12 months, so I had a road car, and then I sold it to buy a racing car and never had a road car.
So he had to be a taxi?
Yeah, but he didn't.
He wasn't, even though he was driving past?
No, drove straight past the door. He hated motor racing and never, ever wanted me to have anything to do with it. And I think he went to two races while he was still alive.
Yeah.
And both times he said to my mum, "Get me out of here, Gene. Get me out of this bloody place." He didn't like it at all.
Every lap in under a minute. Every move made to matter. Every decision impacting the outcome of the race. Supercars in Perth. Every second matters. Bosch Power Tools Perth Super Sprint, May 17 to 19. Book now at Ticketek. Supercars. Unforgettable.
What was your first, do you remember your first race? When was it? Where was it?
Yeah, it was Simmons Plains. 1 week after I turned 17 and got my licence there. So I started racing in, I can't even remember what year that was. It was a long time ago though.
I did some homework.
Yeah.
1971, ring a bell.
That's about right, yeah. It would have been October 1971, which would have been, about a week, I think it was, after my 17th birthday.
So this is sports sedans? Is this what's...
No, there what was a category.
Sort of a category of
No, there was
stuff.
Early model Holdens was a category.
Right. Yeah, right.
And there was... There were heaps of them, you know. There were probably 25 early models even in Tasmania. It was just they were the car you raced, you know. You could find them everywhere and it was like HQ became and now like Hyundai's have become. They were the category of choice in my day.
Were you any good? Do you have a clue what you're doing?
Well, I used to be able to drive it around on two wheels pretty well. There's some good photos of it on two wheels. I suppose it was all a learning thing and, like your mechanical skills, I was 17, the first year apprentice, and luckily I had a few good mates that used to come around and help me a bit. But, you know, she was pretty rough and ready, and we'd be going into the track and I'd be laying under the back putting oil in the diff on the trailer or something while we were lined up to get in. It was, you know, it was all learning. It was all learning, and we just did it, and you did it with your mates. And I'd have, one of my mates would be towing the car for me because I didn't have a car, and we'd have a borrowed trailer off someone else, and that's just how you did it.
It was just...
You winged it and did what you could.
Make it up as you go and...
Shitloads of fun. If you knocked a headlight out of it, you go and get another one because they're laying everywhere, you know. It was just... It was great times and great funs. But those cars were also, you know, pretty highly developed. They were grey engines revving the daylights out of them. We had Repco pistons in them and roller cams and, you know, there was still a lot of technology for the day in those cars, even though you had three-speed on the tree.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Had a double clutch at back to low at the hairpin and four-wheel drum brakes, you know. They were pretty interesting cars.
So what did you develop into? What came next along the line? Was it a case of buy the next fastest car once you've saved up the cash? Or because did you make a profit on that Holden or did you lose? Because you wouldn't remember, surely.
No, I don't remember.
Oh, you must have made a profit on it. You would have remembered it.
You
sure.
know, the car still exists. It's still in Hobart today. And
really?
The family got it down there. Yeah, another guy had it and he actually did a Targa in it.
Oh, like really?
About maybe 15 years ago or something. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I actually had a drive of it at the Storix 1 year.
Yeah.
Yeah, so she still exists and it's still
going.
The wheels still turn. But I can't remember what I got for it. I just remember selling it and I sold it to another mate who's still got the logbook and he's waiting for me to buy it back so that he can sell me the logbook and make a profit on it. So, yeah.
Love it. Love it. Love a good deal. What was next? What did you go into after that from the Holden?
Well, I think... From memory, the next car, Gene Cook built a lightweight Falcon.
Like a four-door or a coupe?
Yeah,
or
it was a four-door, like an XK Falcon with a 3.6 Falcon, 3.6 Ford engine with a cross-low head and Weavers, and it was very, very light and very complicated roll cage in it made out of exhaust tube, single hoop, you know, and every bit of weight pulled out of it and some aluminium panels on it. And when Gene started driving his L34, he let a guy drive it who'd been working for him, and it ended up getting crashed, and it was sort of bent in half, you know, hit the end of the Armco, and I bought the wreck, and a mate of mine, Spider Johnson, and myself rebuilt that car. And Spider was a sheet metal worker, so he just did a beautiful job of that car and built the aluminium panels himself, and, you know, it was just spot on. It was a beautiful car, and that's what I won my first ever race in that car, in the Falcon. I think I was probably 18 or maybe just 19 then.
Did you think, wow, I'm on my way now, won a race?
No. I think when I actually led a race, and it was at Baskerville, I can remember it, and the car was still undercoat grey because we just built it and hadn't quite finished it, and I think I nearly fell off because I got such a shock that I was in front.
You got a bit of practice being in front over the years in various categories and cars, but was there a turbocharged XU1 Tirana at some stage that you...
There was.
It sounds like a bit of a wild thing to go and do.
Yeah, no, everyone in Tassie went for turbocharged Tiranas because Wayne Mankin was a Tasmanian boy who came over here and started Mankin Auto-Tune, and he started specialising in building very fast turbocharged six-cylinder Holden engines, and he had the old Harrop Ron Harrop EH, and he put a turbo six in it, and it was absolute missile while it kept going. And it had passed the V8s, and we all thought, shit, this is the way to go. So I bought a turbocharged engine to put in this Tirana that I'd built, and without great success because I just couldn't stop blowing turbos. I don't know whether it was something I was doing wrong or what the deal was, but we used to blow one turbo after the other and very rarely ever finished a race. And then in the end, a couple of mates, Clive Stafford and Paul Minahan, had been racing an alloy-headed XU1, and they'd stopped racing, and they still had the engine out of the car, and they said, for Christ's sake, put our engine in this car and see how you go. And I put the engine in the car, and immediately I think the first or second meeting I ran it, I won the Tasmanian Sport Sedan Championship in it. So it sort of, then I started winning races because I realised you just don't need the car with the most power, you need the car that finishes as well, you know, and that was when we started winning some races.
So in the 80s, you're not really venturing away from Tassie for car racing yet?
Shit, no, I'd only been to Melbourne once, I think.
So where does the business... I mean, you've trained as a mechanic by this stage, but where does the car, is the car dealer stuff coming soon?
No,
or
no.
Are we a long way off from are we still in the mechanic mode, or what's funding this? How's this all
Well,
going?
Then I was still an apprentice, and I remember, like, when you're a first-year apprentice, I was on $17.50 a week. And then when I bought that Falcon, I remember saying to Ian Johnson, my mate Spider, who helped me build the Falcon, oh, God, if I can't afford it now, I never can, because I was on $25 a week. Ooh. Big money.
Look out.
Big money then, you know, 25 bucks a week. So I was still funding that myself, and I'd work of a night at Gene Cook's workshop at Longford or at the service station at Perth all weekend, and that's how I funded it, just by working and making extra money. Or I'd buy an old Hillman or something off the Reeman Manning used car yard where I was an apprentice, and I'd give her a bit of a clean up, a bit of a spruce up, and she'd be in the paper on Saturday morning, and I might make, you know, 50 bucks or something, and that's how I did it.
Yeah, and just a little bit more. A little bit more.
Yeah, yeah.
Suddenly it gets rolling down the track. So when did it go from fun to, and clearly it's obsessions have probably got a negative connotation to it, but you're putting all your energy into making the bucks, working multiple jobs, buying and selling cars to keep this whole thing rolling along. Was this all of the aim of, I'm going to make this my profession as a driver and this is how I'm going to do it? Or it's a case of, there's no grand plan, I just love doing this, this is the way I have to do it, and who knows where it goes.
There was never a grand plan, and that's the difference now. Like, no one helped you, no one guided you. We just did it because we loved it and just kept doing it. There was never a grand plan, just I wanted to race cars and I didn't know where it might end up. I just did it. And see, from that Tirana, we then, Gene Cook built me, because he was a very good speedway racer and a good fabricator, and we built a chassis that was a scaled down Rayburn chassis off his speedway car and put a Mazda RX-7 body on it, like with panels with a peripheral port rotary. And that car was probably the cheapest, most successful car I'd ever owned in my life, like brand new car with a brand new rotary peripheral port engine, and it cost about $9,000, I think, and that was probably in 1987, I reckon. And it was just so practical and such a great little car and strong and sturdy, and, you know, that's the way race cars should be. It wasn't flimsy, it didn't bend easily, it didn't bend steering arms easily, and it was just a fast, great little car, especially at Baskerville, which was such a handling track. Struggled a bit at Simmons against the big engine, turbo engine sixes and the V8s that were around, but Baskerville, it was as fast as anything.
You guys never worried the fact you only had two tracks to run on?
Well, no, we didn't know much about anything else. We were like Americans. There's no other country exists but Tasmania. We were just locked in there, you know, and we didn't know much about anything else. It's just one of those things. We were there and that was our world.
So by the time you're in this Mazda sports sedan, so we're talking 86, 87 sort of period, I'm presuming the apprenticeship is finished by now, by the way. I think we should be out of the apprenticeship stage at this point, surely.
Yeah, I was.
So what are you doing by this stage?
Yeah, well, I'd done quite a few things. I had, when I was 20, I went into a service station at Perth, which was my first business, with a couple of mates who were older who grew up across the road from me, Ian and Bruce Johnson. And we went into the roadhouse at Perth. But Bruce and his wife had the roadhouse and Spider and I had the service station. And I did the mechanic work and Spider served the petrol and, you know, all that sort of thing. And I went in there, and when I was 20 years old, with Ian half share in the service station, and it was a matter of, I had a old bloody Falcon Road car and a toolbox, and I went to the ANZ Bank at Longford and they lent me 10 grand to go into this service station, which, you know, probably wouldn't happen today. And big that's time. We started off in the service station when I was 20, and I was in there probably till I was 25 or 26. And then I went in just to a workshop in Launceston doing mechanical work, and then it went on from there. And then it's a long story. My business life is a pretty long story.
We'll weave it in as we go. Weave it in. It's part of the story because it sort of helps connect the racing stuff together and why some of the things happened that happened. So for 1989, you get to go to Bathurst.
Yep.
So the little young bloke that's grown up at Longford and seen all this cool stuff, who's been working all these hours to keep his racing cars going, has never been out of Tassie. Maybe by this stage, maybe you've escaped once or twice, but you've
never
pretty
raced
much,
out of Tassie,
never raced, but you might have jumped on a plane here or there.
Yeah.
How did this whole Bathurst thing come up? So for 1989, it's with one of our previous guests on the podcast, Chris Lambden, who you guys paired up together in a Commodore. How did that all come to be? Because very different time then to how you do a Bathurst 1000 deal these days. It's a fairly closed shop compared to back in those days.
Yeah, well, I think that was the beauty of it. It was, you know, everybody could have a goal or a dream, and you could live your dream of getting to Bathurst, you know, even if you're just some little amateur from Tasmania that might be able to find someone that's prepared to give you a drive, and you got to go to Bathurst. But it was, you know, nowhere near what you would expect these days for what driving you need to have done or how you've got to prove yourself before you can get there. And, you know, I think it's, in some ways it's great, but in other ways it's a bit of a pity that's become so elitist, and the amateurs and the people without huge budgets used to be able to get together and put deals together and get to Bathurst. So how it came about was, I think from memory, I'd won my second Tasmanian championship in the Mazda, and Chris had seen me race, and Kerry Bailey, who's another Tasmanian who I'd raced against extensively, and had raced with Chris, I think, the year before.
Bathurst.
And I honestly don't know how it happened, but I know that I had a fine $15,000, which I got from a newspaper in Tasmania called the Sunday Tasmanian, and contributed my 15 grand, and off we went to Bathurst in the VL Commodore, or it would be in those days, in the bow repairs car.
Yeah.
And it was pretty funny, you know, because like everyone has a driving coach now and everyone has people helping
them. Hanger-onerers.
And but older people mentoring them and giving them advice, and Paul Morris training people, and there was none of that in those days, and they did anything that they could to not help you.
Everything but
the opposite. I think one of the funniest things was, you know, one of the funniest things was Chris said, oh, don't worry about the track because, you know, there was no simulators. You didn't get to learn the track on the simulator, and you get up there a bit early and drove around once and you go, holy shit, this place looks a bit steeper than what it did on that old black and white TV. And so he said, oh, don't worry about it. He said, Alan Grice will sort of talk you around and tell you what to do. So because it was an ex-Roadways
car. Roadways-built car,
and Les Small had done the car or built the engine, I think.
Actually, it was the rebuilt car because Chris had backed the original car into the wall at Oran Park.
Had he?
Earlier that year. So
he didn't
actually,
tell me about that.
Yeah. That was the ex-Brock car, but then this car was a new car.
Which Bob Jones.
That's right. Roadways had supplied the engine, I think, to the previous car the previous year, but this was a brand newie for when you... So, yeah, you've turned up for the Enduros in a freshie. How good is that?
Gricey came in to talk me... Like, Chris said, would you just talk Cricky around the
and
track?
And you've never been to Bathurst before, ever.
And he was very helpful. He said to me, look, mate, he said, you know where the pit exit is over there? He said, you drive out there, you turn left. He said, go up that straight. And then he said, turn right and turn left again and climb up over that hill. He said, and you'll be right. And that was it.
Insightful.
Yeah. Not very helpful at all.
How did it all go? How did that first Bathurst go?
Not very well. From memory, I think it blew head gaskets, and I think, you know, through the race, I think they put some head gaskets on it and we got going again. So I got my first lot of laps at Bathurst, and I suppose that was the start.
Yeah. And you went back the next year, but not in a Commodore.
No.
It was a Nissan.
In a Nissan HR31.
That car was a very good car for him during that year, and you guys finished top 10 in both the Enduros as well. So
yeah, it was a ripper car.
An ace situation.
At Bathurst for a start, like I think you'll tell me if I'm wrong, but I think we finished seventh.
Was it ninth or eighth? It was back half of the top 10.
Well, we were in the top 10 anyway. That car stopped every lap for however many laps we completed because there was a sensor failed in the morning warm up and no one could find out what it was, and Gibson's never had the time to come and look at it because they were trying to run their own cars, and it every lap for 160 whatever laps we did, it actually stopped and we'd have to turn it off and turn it back on again.
With the key or with a button?
I think it was. I can't remember what was in it, but we had to restart it because it would go
off
and shut down, and we just had to restart it. And we got through that race and finished in the top 10, which was a terrific result. And I think the same thing happened at Sandown, but you know better than me. I can't remember.
Yeah, I was there.
My biggest memory of Sandown is I remain nameless, but I had a mate who was in the armed robbery squad over here, and I was talking to Chris about it the other day, but he couldn't remember it. But they knew I was there, and he was all stirring me about, you need to come to the advanced driving school at the police academy. We'll show you how to drive. So the garage, after practice, the garage doors flew open at Sandown, the old tin sheds there, and in came the armed robbery squad and threw me over the back of the car and put handcuffs on me and took me out and threw me in the squad car, the light on the roof, and off they went down Springvale Road. And everyone's going, what's he done?
Everyone thinks you've just been nabbed.
Yeah. And they just took off and went around the block and then took me back and let me out. Imagine how much trouble they'd be in for that, doing something like that these days.
It doesn't happen these days. That's for sure. So while we're around this sort of period of this stuff, what do you call Lambden? What's your nickname for him?
Spin. That's Kiwi for spin.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, he used to spin a lot.
Oh, did he? Does he know this?
Yeah, of course he does.
You've only been calling him that for, 30 years? Why stop now?
No, but fair dinkum, though. We had a good great time and pretty good success for what we had in those endurance races, and that was the opportunity I got to get started going to Bathurst.
Do you know how to find the right oil for your car? Now you can find out quickly and easily online. Thanks to Castrol's Rego to Oil tool. Simply type in your rego, select your state, And within seconds, you'll know the best Castrol products to unlock the edge of performance in your car. So what's your car best suited to? Just search Rego, the number 2, and oil, and find out.
Around that time too, mate, and this is a thing I wanted to delve into a bit with you, that the Honda Prelude sports sedan was coming on the scene in 1990. Yep. So same time, same year, obviously the enduros are a different thing, but how did that all come to be, that sports sedan that you won the national championship in? Tell me about that and where the concept for it came from, the origins and how it came to be.
Cause it's a pretty cool interesting car. So I suppose in 1989 I'd sold my transport business and decided I wanted to be a car dealer for some stupid reason. But anyway, the new Shape Prelude was out that had a really low frontal area and I thought it was just, you know, it was an ideal car to build a sports sedan out of. And I'd been talking to Tony Edmondson about it and Don Elliott, who owned Elfin Sports Cars at the time, and they thought it was the ideal car. You know, the basic dimensions of the car were perfect, really low frontal area, and I had access to get all the new panels and that from Honda to build the car.
Just because you were a dealer for
Honda? Yeah, I was a Honda dealer.
That's what
and
you started as.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to build it, and I wanted to have a Honda engine in it. But that became too difficult. At the end of the day, we got an IndyCar engine, which I think must have been based on a production block in those days, and we thought, you beauty, we've got an engine we can put straight in this car. But when we got it and pulled it apart, the Americans had been into it and ground the shit out of everything, and no combustion chambers, no nothing left inside it, so we couldn't use that. So the original plan was just to have a 302 Chev, because Tony was of the view that that car didn't need a 350 or the big horsepower, because it was going to be light and nimble, and it wouldn't need the torque. But in the end, we couldn't get parts for a 302, so I'd end up with a 350 Chev in it, which was very mild. It was probably just a good boat engine, really. It had 475 horsepower. When I sold it to John Briggs and Mark McLaughlin Dyno, it had 475 horsepower, so it was not a big horsepower car.
But the weight, and, I guess, was
what? Well, there was a minimum weight. It was built light, but I think it ended up having to be 980 kilos or something at the time, so we had to put weight in it. But the car, the most interesting thing is the chassis. Like, it was the first car in Australia. It was an aluminium honeycomb, and it had a carbon fibre front clip that was actually glued and riveted onto the front of the aluminium honeycomb chassis. And all the front suspension hung off that, and everyone said, oh, that won't last one season. That's going to fall off and you're going to die in it. You know, like that was...
Gee, thanks for the confidence.
Yeah. No, well, that's what everyone thought. But unbeknownst to them, I think there was technology involved in that car that most people here didn't know about. Carlo Linetta, Carlo Carbon 5 from Adelaide, was worked on the car, and he built it from scratch. And his brother, I think, who still works in the Ferrari... engineering department, and I think he was Schumacher's race engineer for four of his world championships, so had all that knowledge of those two people behind it, and they were involved, and I think he was heavily involved in the concept of the car, because the car is very, very similar to what the car he built, which was the Alfa Pro car.
With the Formula One engine.
Engine, and if you have a look at the chassis, apart from the fact that the engine's further forward to meet our rules, it's very, very similar to what that Alfa Pro car was. So I think that's where the concept came from for that car. And, you know, to this day, I reckon you could get that car out, and I've seen it a few years ago. She's a bit of a mess now, like it needs a lot of work. It needs a complete strip and rebuild, but I think you could still rebuild that car and be at the front end of the sports at Anfield. The chassis was that good.
It was a couple of memorable cars, I remember, because there was the national championship was pretty strong in the early 90s. So there's you, there's the Riccadello Alfa, Kerry Bailey's Supra, you mentioned Kerry before. Keith Carling ended up with a 300ZX Nissan after being in a Mazda, Desi Wall in a Supra. You know, there was quite a decent
Monteroso and
the little Escort. The Jag was floating around too, the Colourbond Jag. There was some pretty cool cars. Like that racing, was that good racing from what you recall?
Oh, it was. Yeah, it was great. It was very competitive, and it was good racing. Like Mick Monteroso's car used to be just an absolute missile in a straight line.
A tiny escort with a big Chevy.
You'd never beat him off the line. So you know, if you were on the front row, even if you're on pole, you know you were going to get beaten off the line. You'd have to work your way past him somehow. So there was some good racing. It was close racing, and like I remember one day at Lakeside with Gary Scott. I passed him round the outside through the kink at Lakeside and hit that bump, and I think I just landed on the outside edge of the track and made it around there by pure luck, you know. and then it was good racing. It was very competitive, but those cars were hard work and hard work to keep going, and I never really had the money. When I built that car, it went pretty well over the budget, but you know, in today's budget's nothing. I think we thought it was going to cost $100,000 to build it, and I reckon it cost $180,000. Mm. And I won the championship, and then the next year I think we had the car sorted a lot better, and we'd won the first two races quite easily, and I thought, I want to get out of this and move on to something else. I had the idea that I could get into supercars, so I sold it to John Briggs and sort of moved on.
It's a bit of a theme in your racing that you've got your business world going as well. So you're in and out a couple of times along the way, but this was the moment when you're going, right, I'm going to we call it main game now, don't we? Touring car racing, was then.
But really all I ever wanted to do was do Sandown and Bathurst, and maybe if I could do a few races through the year, because I always had my business first, and by this time I had young children. You just think, I've got to keep working.
Yeah. Were Honda okay with the Honda Sports then? Because it wasn't a Honda.
Yeah, like they didn't mind.
No, just put the Honda name out there. Because it was white?
No, it was red initially. We painted it white. I think David White, who used to be at Channel 10, got me some money from the Tasmanian government to do the IndyCar event and that, and it was white then.
Mm.
Yeah.
Because it was red with black and shell, I think, from memory. Yeah. It was on it for a time. But so you won the championship in 91, and then 92 was that year that you mentioned that you started and
did the first round and just bailed out.
Yeah. But 92 brings some other good things into play here.
Yeah.
So 92 is the start of Targa.
Yeah.
Targa Tassie. How do you end up tied in there? Because at the time this was this really new, this is a bit different for anything that we had in Australian motorsport, this tarmac rally and Tasmania and driving around and nice cars and some big names. It was big news, big stuff. Did you see this and go, I have to have a go at this? Or did something else happen to sort of lead the pathway to it?
Well, I was a Honda dealer and I knew the event was going to happen. I thought, I've got to do this somehow. And the NSX had just been launched, so I went to them and asked them whether they might be interested in doing the event in NSX, and they didn't give me an answer because Honda in Australia are always pretty conservative. They weren't all that wrapped in motor racing. And then they must have thought about it and decided that it would be a good promotion, so they decided to do a two-car team, and they put something together with myself and Jack Brabham in two Honda NSXs. So they didn't have much faith in me because they were concerned that I would make a mess of it and probably embarrass Honda. So they gave my car to a dealer, Robert Lane, who was a Honda dealer at Brighton, who then gave the car to me to run. So that car ran with Robert Lane Honda on it. And Jack, we were a factory team, but essentially they probably put me at arm's length.
Just in case.
So, you know, here's this kid that used to run across the road getting Jack Brabham's autograph, and all of a sudden he was my teammate.
That's pretty cool.
It was, yeah.
That's got to be mind blowing. You would have never, your first race 71, so here you are nearly 20 years later.
Yeah.
And the bloke is your teammate. Yeah. That's impressive.
It was pretty amazing, and I got to know him very well, and he was just as you know, sometimes they say you don't want to know your heroes, but he was a sensational old guy. And what I learnt from him, and I talked to him probably very regularly up until the time he passed, because he'd ring me up when he was going to get his his dialysis.
Kidney. Yeah.
And I think that he thought that the phone calls were costing him money, so I'd ring me up, ring me in half an hour, I'm going to have this dialysis, and I get bored. So I'd ring him up and we'd talk about motor racing, he'd tell me about Grand Prix, and his recall and his memories were just unbelievable. You know, how he could remember everything that happened in the Grand Prix, and how Bruce was catching him, so he ran off the road and pelted rocks at him and laughed because Bruce was bleeding after the race from the face, and he'd remember everything, remember absolutely everything. So that was phenomenal for me, you know, to sort of get to know him.
So you winning that first Targa Tasmania probably wasn't in Honda's thought process at the time.
I don't think it was in anyone's thought process.
What about yours?
It wasn't. Yeah, I always thought I could win it.
Yeah.
You know, everyone said, oh, he won it because he knows the roads. But there was roads there that I had never been on in my life before in Tassie. But there's something about the roads there and the winding roads and that. We grew up on them and we practiced on them quite a bit. So, you know, you learn to read roads, you learn to read different surfaces, and you'll get corners on those mountain passes that are wet in areas and dry somewhere else. So, you know, there's a lot of skills, and I think that's why we've got so many good Kiwi racing drivers, because it's a similar place. Mm. And I think that helped me. And, yeah, winning that event with my old mate Greg Priest, who we grew up together, he was a rally navigator, and to win that was a big thrill, to win that in front of our home crowd, and in that early day when it was such a huge event and there was so much support for the event in the state.
Had you even done a tarmac rally before that stage? You'd just done circuit racing.
I never had a navigator in the car. And Preece still laughs about it today. He said I wouldn't have got to the first start of the first stage if I hadn't had him with me, because I couldn't find my way anywhere. And I couldn't, you know, they'd have notes and I didn't listen to the notes at first, and it took me a long time, and I had no concept of distance. Like, we used to break markers and he'd be calling down, you know, 500, 200, and I didn't know how far 500 metres was in the car. So we had to go out in the highway, and we found this place where they measured the metres on the taxis, and it's marked on the road. So we went out there, so I got used to how far 500 metres was, or 200 metres. Yeah.
High-tech
training. Yeah, it was very high-tech.
It worked.
Yeah.
What was the appeal about Targa back then? Was it because it was fresh and new and had big names and was just such a – I mean, tarmac rallying, there's Targa insert name here everywhere now in Australia, and obviously there's a there's been a bit going on with all things Targa in the last little while. But was it because it was just new and fresh and different that it was so big? Why did it work straight away so well?
Well, that's what it was. It was just unique. And it was the first big motorsport event that we'd had in Tasmania since Longford. Longford was enormous. And all of a sudden, you've got this Targa event, you've got all these unique cars, and John Large did a fantastic job in making the event very special, and special cars. You couldn't enter in just anything. It had to be a unique car. It had to be a special car. And, that was part of the draw card. Every school you went past, all the kids were out in the footpath. There were people everywhere. And then you had Jack Brabham, Denny Holm, you know, Sandra Minari, Roger Clark, all these international, Sterling Moss, all these international names coming to the event that had never been to Tasmania since Longford. So I think that was part of the success.
Does it stand out as the most successful or important motorsport achievement of your career? Because Tassie boy, Tassie event, inaugural event, Honda dealer, Honda car, Jack Brabham teammate, that's pretty hard to top.
Yeah, I suppose it was. I guess it is. But it was just another step in, you know, my love of circuit racing, really. It was a big achievement. It was something I had trouble handling, though, because all of a sudden everyone in Tasmania knew who it was, and I didn't handle that, and I didn't like it very much.
You just like being just cricky?
Yeah.
People would recognise you on the street know you or...
Yeah, I did, and I wasn't used to that, you know. Yeah. I wasn't used to that, but and it's quite hard to get used to.
How did you not handle it well? What would you have done differently?
I don't know what I'd do, because essentially I think I'm pretty shy, and I just like to do what I like to do. And I understand how some of these really big sports stars, from my little bit there, how they have trouble coping with it. Some cope with it really well, some don't.
Mm. So you didn't help yourself really by winning it again the next year, did you really? If you're trying to keep it low key.
Well, it helped me on the fact that, you know, there were people that said, I only won it because he knew the roads and all this sort of thing. And then when we went back the next year, and I think we probably won it easier the next year.
Was that in the Dogbone car?
Yeah, in Ross Palmer's Dogbone car. Yeah, which Honda leased off Ross Palmer, and it had been crashed badly by Wayne Gardner.
It was post Bathurst 12-hour repair job.
And it was at a patch-up repair job, and they did a really good job of fixing it, the TAFE guys at Bathurst, but they struggled to fix it because those cars were so strong, they couldn't just pull it out. They had to cut it and cut the aluminium subframes and had to pull them back straight. So, but it was a good car. You know, that was almost...
Better than the first year?
Yeah. The first year was a completely standard car, standard tyres, standard brakes. We had different pads and different brake fluid, but lap sash seat belts, no roll cage.
Yeah.
And then the next year we had a proper car with a roll cage in it and harnesses that held you in place. Old Priest used to end up on top of me with his notes just about in some places, you know, and it was a big, big improvement. And the car was sort of basically, I suppose you'd say it was an NSX-R.
And what did that do for the business too as well? That was what I was going to ask you.
Well, it certainly made a difference to our business. In Tasmania, yeah. Mm. A big, big difference. Our Honda sales jumped like you wouldn't believe, so it did have a big effect on the business.
That second year, I think that was the year that the 968 Porsches ran and Jimmy Richards, I think, arrived, and then Mazdas came in the years that followed. Did you wind back from it after that? Or?
Well, Honda did it for a couple of years and just didn't want to do it again. And then a dealer, one of the dealers... John Trevett, who was a big Honda dealer and BMW, lots of multi-franchise dealerships in Western Australia and in New South Wales, he supplied me with the car to do it again in 94. But another NSX. I clipped a bank, I think it was in day two. We actually made a very, very bad tyre choice. We got some tyres that we thought were going to be far better and... they turned out to be not so good. They weren't quite what the tyre dealer had told us they were. They were like, I think they had sparks coming off them. They were that hard. And there was something that had been rejected by one of the OEM supplied. They were an OEM tyre that were being supplied to Porsche that had been rejected. And somehow they got to Australia and they were sold to us. And Dick Johnson had them on his Barchetta too. And I remember Dick and I both spinning out at... you know, snail's pace driving to a stage at the side.
Oh, not even in the stage?
No.
Oh, jeez.
No, they were undrivable.
Ugh.
So that messed that year up a bit. And then that same car, John asked me to go and do the Cannonball Run with his son in the car with me, so we did that, which was sort of fun but, you know, pretty traumatic and bad memories because we came across that F40 Ferrari. We had the second car to pull up there and I'm going, where's the officials?
Because it's just in the middle of nowhere at the end of a stage, wasn't it? Yeah. Which was this, for those who might not know, it was an event that Alan Moffat had been heavily involved in putting together, inspired by the American movies of the Cannonball Run and up through the Northern Territory, and the government backed it. And it was 94, I think that was the year that one happened. And, you know, had a bunch of, I think Greg Hansford did it.
Yeah.
And it's a bunch of familiar names and known motorsport people. And
probably the most fun I had on that event was with Greg Hansford. We just had a ball. We had so much fun. It was very unique, and it was another unique opportunity to get to know one of our icons.
Legend. Motor, four wheels, two wheels, one on them all, pretty much anywhere he went. So that, did you do Targas after those few years with the Hondas?
And then I think it was probably, I lose track of the years, but I reckon it was probably 2000. Honda gave me a couple of, we'd done that IndyCar.
Oh, the Young Guns.
Young Guns thing, which Marcus won.
Yep, in the Integras.
In the Integras, and there were heaps of these Integras, so they gave me two of them.
Were any of them any good after those young blokes?
Not much.
Thrashed them around?
There were a couple of good ones, the one Marcus drove and the one that Christian Jones drove, Alan's son. They were pretty much unmarked, but a lot of them weren't too good. But anyway, we had two of those, and Honda gave us two of those, and I drove one, and Bob Jennings, a motoring journalist, drove the other one. And that was a lot of fun because it was a wet event, and we actually finished six outright in a Honda Integra front-wheel drive.
Pretty good.
Yeah, they were a little missile, those cars, and they were so quick, especially on a wet road.
There you have it, part one of my sit-down chat with Greg Crick. Good news is part two and part three are to come. You can check out the V8 Sleuth podcast library for those if you're catching up on the episodes. But if you're listening to this one within a week of us dropping part one, you just got to hold your horses. It's coming soon, and I can tell you it is worth the wait. Before I go, Castrol Motorsport News Podcast, make it part of your weekly motorsport listening habits every Tuesday with Andrew Van Leeuwen and Stefan Bartholomaeus for the latest motorsport insights and analysis, keeping the motorsport news name alive in a new era. The boys are award-winning, agenda-setting, setting the pace, best insight and analysis in the game, all that stuff. They are on it. And thank you to everyone who listens to the Castrol MM pod, because the post Newcastle 500 episode was the biggest, most downloaded episode in the pod's history. So thank you to everybody who's been jumping on board for their fix of motorsport news every week. Thanks for tuning in. Love the support that we get from our V8 Sleuth listeners. Keep the suggestions and the feedback rolling in via the socials and email, and I look forward to joining you next time next week. Bye for now.
Every lap in under a minute means every second matters. Bosch Power Tools Perth Super Sprint, May 17 to 19. Book now at Ticketek. Supercars, unforgettable.